From Brighton on the English South Coast, these are the voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums with Dr. Sophie Frost.
Hello, I'm Sophie, and I've spent the past 9 months wandering the corridors of the Royal Pavilion and Museums in Brighton and Hove, otherwise known as RPM, uncovering the stories of the museum people who keep Brighton's historic buildings and collections relevant, vibrant, and accessible for the world we're living in. In Series 1, I spoke with Dr. Helen Mears and consultant and activist Sarah Lee about how the legacy of South Coast colonialism in the collections of Royal Pavilion and Museums has been disrupted and reframed by new museum practices, notably the forward-thinking Fashioning Africa collection project. In this episode, I'm joined by Rachel Hemingway-Hurst, curator of world art at Brighton Museums, and Edith Ojo, freelance arts consultant and key advisor on the Fashioning Africa project. Before speaking with Rachel and Edith, I'm embarrassed to say that I'd never heard of Yoruba, Asooke textiles or fashion. But as soon as I Googled it, I recognised the vibrant images which I found. I've seen these splendid outfits many a Sunday morning near my home in South London, worn by women and girls from the local West African community on their way to church. Rachel and Edith begin by explaining the history and culture behind Asooke in this episode, helping us to understand the symbolic importance of a British coastal museum collecting these textiles, and how this model of collecting can enable previously unheard stories to be told. Enjoy. Helen and Sarah talk quite a lot about Fashioning Africa, and that's really interesting, but I think focusing in objects would probably be really good.
So I guess the first way we sort of started to work together as individuals probably, I guess, was looking at Edith collecting Asooke for us. So it was the idea that you came up with an idea for a fabric that was really culturally and socially important. And then us realising that through our panel members, we had some people who could really help us with the next phase of the project. So people came up with ideas, but then we've got ideas of what to collect and things, but then how do we do that? And then Edith's like, well, I'm really keen to collect Asooke. It's very culturally important in Nigeria. So we said, okay, let's have a look at doing that. So us working together to kind of think about how we were going to find the collection, how you were going to help
source
us to do
them.
That.
Yes. Yeah. The panel was really instrumental in us getting to that point, because whilst we were on the panel, we all collectively, there's about 10 of us, came up with a criteria that we wanted to focus on, and it ranged from issues to do with, you know, reflecting the politics of, you know, Africa and how that's reflected in material culture, particularly textiles, issues to do with indigenous cultures as well, you know, what's locally made and locally relevant still, you know. So we were interested in looking out for stuff that particularly reflected the indigenous African culture and markets and lots of other things. But I think you're right, Asooke was a perfect fit for that last criteria I mentioned, because it is worn by, well, it originated from Southwest Nigeria, but is now worn widely across Nigeria and other parts of, some parts of West Africa. It's indigenous to that region and is manufactured still within that region. So the market's very local, and the market's important to the ecology of it, because it's such a thriving business, and it sort of spreads out into issues around gender, socio-cultural issues. So by the time we explored all of these issues, generally everyone like agreed that this was a piece of culture that they would like to see represented within the museum's collection, which was amazing. And, you know, for me, because it meant that, yeah, I could go off and help them collect some items, which I did. I was set the task of to collect 3 full sets of Asooke fashion. So that was another departure, because a lot of textiles within the collection are were collected as textiles, so flat fabric. And one of the things I really wanted to reflect, and I think you, the museum, agreed with this, was that we needed to, with African textiles, also reflect the fashion, so the indigenous fashion, and to look at the changes within the fashion practices as well, and talk about the culture as well.
Yeah.
The social relevance of
and change. Know. They only kind exactly. of the things that we've got before maybe told you one moment in history, and it was a very colonial story and it was a very static story. And the Ashoka collection that we have now that Edith has put together has, we have contemporary piece that you commissioned in Nigeria, we have diaspora outfits in the UK. They tell a multitude of stories and they move across the themes really Absolutely. Well, which is nice as well.
Mm. They the do move of, across the different themes we set yeah. around gender,
transformation,
markets,
evolution, sustainability,
you know, sustainability change. Of the markets. So many things made this particular
maybe textile. Resistance in forms of Ashoka, similarly to Kente cloth. We've got but a Kente collection as well from Ghana, and similarly they kind of really symbolise the kind of post-colonial importance and reinvigorating cultural value. I don't know if you think Ashoka does the same kind of thing.
Not in the same way with Kente, not in that political sense, but Ashoka does it in a not so obvious way, because it's a fabric that's been widely embraced by the community that wear it, and it's just got this vibrancy, and you know, people look at it as a fabric that's just there to stay. It's never going away, and it just has a life of its own, you know.
It has a life of its own, and it has a real power, a real sense of power. It really shouts at you, I mean, in a really beautiful way, but it's really like, I'm here and this is what I represent. And I think it's so interesting that things like, I think surprising the project, that a fabric, a garment, a look, a fashion can speak so loudly and say so much.
The fashion sector around Ashoka is a thriving sector, and other markets have tried to come in to sort of, you know, I don't know, modernize, change, make it more efficient, but the manufacturers have basically been rejected by the people because they prefer the older way of doing, of creating that fabric, and so in a way that's preserved the local market.
Would you say that? So do you mean the
Woven as opposed to machine woven? Yeah. It's not been embraced so well.
Just to rewind slightly, so was there any Ashoka textiles in the collection before Edith came along? Was it based on something that was already starting to exist, what had existed in the collection, or was it something that needed to happen?
A bit of both, in terms of, we had some Yoruba gowns, men's gowns, and some of them have Ashoka. I would say we didn't even know we had Ashoka, that for a start.
Right.
Because before you kind of identified that for us, we didn't really know. So actually, when we went back to our historic text, we're like, oh, we do have a few examples, but not very much. No.
You had a lot of Hausa gowns, dashikis.
Which is a more northern culture in Nigeria. Yeah. So, and in our collection, we have a lot of Yoruba sculpture and objects made of wood and other domestic pieces or spiritual pieces, but not so much.
Most of the items you had were sort of pre-colonial items.
Definitely.
And then you had this gap. The immediate post-colonial period, and then
a gap in everything, in terms of, that was the, you know, one of the aims of the project, because the collections go up to the 40s. Kind of, we, in inverted commas, you know, stopped collecting in about the 40s, and then there was no story from there. That was, you know,
we had nothing coherent.
Yes. So this was a way of building a coherent collection that told really rich stories, and Ashoka is a really good kind of example of a.
I think because of its predominance, I think it's such an important fabric. It, to me, felt like something that needed to happen, and would have been a glaring omission if it hadn't been included.
And we wouldn't have got that collection, we wouldn't have got the richness, we wouldn't have got the contacts, we wouldn't have got the provenance, because we're really important to collect objects that talk about individual people's stories rather than a broad, sweep colonial history. And that was really important that Edith was working on that aspect where, for example, our amazing wedding collection where we have the wedding videos and we have the photographs, we have the whole kind of story.
Could you tell us about that?
Yeah.
The wedding collection.
So the museum wanted to change the way they collect and the way they record the items collected. So if you look back at older items within the museum's collection, you can't really tell a lot about them. So when they asked me to collect, one of the conditions was to provide rich context. And so we set out doing that. I think we were very lucky to find individuals within the UK, actually. So we were not only, I mean, we were able to tell a story that's located in Nigeria, but we were also able to tell a sort of diasporic story. But practically speaking, it was also easier to be able to build a relationship with those individuals, because if you need to provide rich context, you need to have contact and you need to build a relationship. I think that was the thing that came out of this, was the time needed and the capacity needed to build those relationships was something that, I don't know about you, but I really didn't expect. I wasn't really prepared for. But it worked, and it worked because I think we were all open to using our social capital, in a sense, networks, friends, family. Yeah. So we were very fortunate that there were individuals within Brighton who I knew and was able to sort of push, nudge,
sweet talk,
beg. And yeah, we were fortunate to get items from them.
Right.
And to collect stories. So one in particular are a couple who've lived in Brighton since the 90s. They have a family of four. They had their wedding in Lagos and London and had these amazing outfits in their loft that had been sitting there for years. And it was really fortunate, I think, and in a mutually beneficial way, because I was able to explain to them that, you know, this would be of great benefit to the community. The items would be preserved, you know, because obviously those items are of value to the owners. If they weren't, they wouldn't have kept them for so long. And so it was mutually beneficial. They saw the value in what we were doing, and I think through dialogue and negotiation, we were also able to, in the end, demonstrate to them that we valued their items and were able to purchase it at a price that was mutually acceptable to both parties. I think that's important to mention because, you know, I think that demonstrated the respect we had for them and that made them also value the project and what we were doing. And once that was established, we were then also able to get a lot more out of them in terms of the context, the stories, which required a lot of meetings. They were part of the oral history collection as well, so we got someone to interview them. So we had, just in terms of the context, we've been able to build. We have obviously the dates, the material information about the items, the socio-cultural information. So they told us about the weddings, and there were lots of events linked to these weddings. They had about 5 events, and we were able to collect items from 3 of those events.
From
3 of those events, and to collect the whole story. We had videos from their wedding, we had photographs, we've got the oral history. So, you know, if in 100 years' time anyone was interested in finding out about Ashoke from 1995 or Nigerian UK diaspora, or weddings in Africa. You know, that I would hope that it would be recorded in a way that they would be able to access all of those that all of that information. It's so rich compared to what we had.
Yeah.
You know, when looking back at items from the 40s and 60s, which would probably just say the date, the name of the collector, not the name of the owner, and the material.
Not very rich.
Not very rich. Not very rich.
I remember having hours and hours of video, and I don't know what's going on. I'm thinking a wedding. No. There's all these different wedding ceremonies. And then sort of talking to Edith and say, how do we kind of, you know, construct this or show other people how this works in quite a simple way? So Edith would go through the footage and go through the album and say, okay, I'm going to pick images that visually tell a simple story of the stages of a Yoruban wedding, so that people can understand who do not have Yoruban culture. So that sort of thing was interesting in the way you're helping to construct that, and that's something we wouldn't have been able
but
to do.
But essentially to understand the object as well, within the context of that video and the photos.
Yeah.
And
tells a really nice
exactly
simple narrative that people can understand, because it's very complex and there's lots of different things going on, and it provides us a way of really making that accessible to people who are not familiar with Yoruba heritage and these very rich ceremonies, contexts, history that just would be impenetrable otherwise.
Yeah.
And the other thing that would be nice to talk about is the idea of value. Mm-hmm. And when we first started, this was a real learning curve for us, wasn't it? This amazing collection happened quite early on. We were really, really keen to work with this family and to, you know, acquire this material, and it was very exciting. And we didn't really have much to go on. And we asked a very reputable dealer about the value, and he gave us a price which was quite low, because he's saying there isn't a market at the moment. And then we started to kind of negotiate, Edith and I. We started to sort of talk about this, and then you went back and talked to them, and we kind of.
There was quite
a few things that we unpicked and thought, actually, we need to be ethically thinking about, that you helped us to kind of establish.
To tease out, yes. Well, it's interesting. He's a dealer, so there is a market.
He's a dealer. Oh, yeah, okay, so yes, he is, yes. But mainly for his older historic pieces is where he's kind of situated.
Yes.
So we didn't really have anyone to ask.
I think also, within his practice, he has probably through the years given more consideration to the end buyer as opposed to the his sourcing, maybe not methods, but pricing. So this for us was a really good opportunity to really think about the outfits within the context of the culture, and the fact that there's so much diversity within the Ashoke manufacturing. You can buy really cheap ones that may be really cheap ones, but you can also buy very expensive ones that people would wear to their weddings, you know. And so we had to have discussions around that, and the ones that we were looking at, the ones that I'd been asked to collect, were specifically wedding outfits. I think I was told to collect some wedding outfits and some special occasion wear.
Special occasion wear,
And so they would be right there at the top in terms of cost, in terms of the value within that particular social cultural context, in terms of the way the owners value them, and also there's another thing that this dealer probably hadn't factored into the cost that he suggested to you, which is the emotional significance to the person you're buying it from. There's just some things you can't put a price on.
I think it was based on if you'd gone and found it at a market with no provenance, with, you know, it's just a piece of textile.
It would just be a piece of textile.
Yeah.
So we had some reference points, you know?
Yeah.
Yes. It's a professional relationship with the museum that I value and a personal relationship with the individuals that we were collecting from that I also equally valued. And I wanted to be able to walk away feeling like I had been fair to everyone, that they would be happy with where we ended up. And I'd like to think that we all...
Do you feel it was in any way unfairest to put you in that situation? Because I don't think we realise... I think, you know, we didn't maybe realise the responsibility or... You know, I think it's kind of a new thing for all of us.
It's a new thing for all of us. And I think we sort of came to that point and then realised how important it was. And no, I don't think it... I didn't mind it at all. I think I was glad it was me as well. I was glad... Well, that sounds a bit big-headed, but no, I was glad it was...
Because
I felt like I took on the responsibility quite well.
But
you know what I mean? I would have been upset if I had found out that such negotiations took place. Said it in a clumsy way, but I'm glad I was part of that process.
Yes.
Is what I mean.
But I also think saying what you're saying about how I think some people would have struggled with that, and I think we haven't really talked about Edith's background or, you know, in terms of your profession and who you've worked with in the past and things, because I think the fact that you've worked for the Arts Council, the fact that you studied at SOAS, a very robust idea of history and African culture, and, you know, I think that's maybe we lucked out in terms of who you are and what you've done before and your thought, because you're used to thinking in those kind of processes where maybe some people might not, and it might have been throwing people more in the deep end. But I don't know what you feel about that.
Well, thank you. But I also think we were lucky with the people we were working with, the people we were getting the items from. And I think we were also lucky that the museum were, you know, Rachel and Helen were really open to having those discussions and changing the narrative, you know, changing the narrative of how museums relate, well, changing the relationship between museums and communities. Yeah. But we also had individuals, you know, the people we were sourcing those items from were very... they didn't need to sell it to us. They were confident individuals. They understood the value of what we were doing, but, you know, they didn't need to sell it to us. So I'm really pleased that we had individuals who had a very strong sense of self, their identities. They were secure individuals, you know, and they didn't do it for the money, but they also felt like they needed to be valued and their cultures needed to be valued. I think we were lucky all round.
Also, just such a innovative and really relatively new way of conducting museum business that was based on care, nurture, reciprocity, ethics. It was about discussion rather than taking, which is maybe what's always been how a lot of the collection has amassed. It's such a hugely kind of important way of undertaking museum activity. Something I just want to touch on a bit more is the responsibility for the museum as this site where we need to build collections like this for communities who don't know about other communities. That's what I'm hearing a lot. Kind of, that seems to be the main purpose of this whole Fashioning Africa project, was to build a collection that did properly profile more accurately what's happening in the world. Is that right?
Yeah. And moving forward from, so the idea of the kind of post-colonial, you know, everything kind of stops. Everything doesn't stop in terms of our collection, everything kind of stops. And the world doesn't stop, and African countries, societies, diasporas don't stop. It's like, how do we move forward and tell new stories, which are really important? And we're now, that's also history. You know, we're creating history all the time. That's actually 1960s, 1950s, when we start looking at things like the Kente fabric that we have from 1957, the year of independence, and gone, look how much has happened in the African continent and in terms of diaspora, you know, in that's like now 70 years. That's that's history. I think a lot of museums now, you know, we're starting to go there. What's happening in that period of time? And it's really important how we document that and tell that history differently. You know, who's telling that history? Whose voices are we representing? And I think this is an opportunity to be doing things differently in how we tell the story of the last 70 years and how we move forward.
I think it's key to bear in mind that the museum collection, before the Fashion in Africa program started, the museum collection of African items is considered to be of national significance. Am I right in saying that?
International significance, possibly.
So it's a very significant museum as far as African material culture is concerned.
And particularly the textiles, so it has designated status.
So that's what I was trying to remember.
Yeah, designated
status. It has designated status.
Right.
Not many people are aware of that. It is an amazing museum when it comes to, you know, a lot of the work that we've been doing. But it had this gap. You have a danger of slipping into irrelevance, really, if you don't maintain it. Not for the museum, but for community, for the nation, for the world. So the first responsibility of the museum that I saw was to maintain that status for Brighton and Hove and Sussex and the nation. It's the first time in how many years that they were collecting items again. And not many museums are in that fortunate position to collect even today.
Yeah, and well, I think it's little pockets of things here and there, but not a kind of the idea of a coherent collecting program. I mean, the funding is a Heritage Lottery funded program called Collecting Cultures. So it specifically allows museums to build a new collection, which is filling gaps or more relevant. So it's quite an amazing program.
Yes.
We went to an event at the British Museum and we come back and I'm thinking about things and I can say to you, I don't quite understand this idea of they're talking about criminality or kind of, and you'll be like, oh, okay, so that is blah, 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 blah. There's probably things I can read, but that's not going to...
I think it comes back to what you said about the individuals as well. And so I think through this project, the responsibilities, Rachel said, was immense. But I think it necessarily meant that the museum had to look at ways of bringing in the individuals with the knowledge
where do we get the knowledge from?
But you know,
it's out there, it's just getting it from different places to rather than me sitting there reading a book written by someone a long time ago.
It was an opportunity to value those individuals and to rebuild a relationship. I think in many ways this was a relationship building exercise.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was.
For us personally, for us as a group.
Between the museum and different communities as well.
Yeah.
Have you seen it trickle out in elsewhere? Should it? Or what's it reliant on? I mean, obviously you had the grant.
I mean, I would say it's reliant on funding, on individuals at the museum and the museum-wide embracing this way of working and relinquishing control. My personal experience is if you relinquish control or whatever, you kind of gain control in terms of organisationally, in terms of what you're doing. It's made me feel so much more confident about what I'm doing because I feel I have peers, I have people that I can go to that will help. But I think you have to be willing to go there. And also, is it your normal way of practice? I mean, for me, I guess in jobs that I've done in the past in museums, I've done a lot of different types of jobs, including lots of audience development, and there's different. So for me, it's a really natural way of working. And I think it's that. And I think most of us, it is, but I think it comes down to definitely it's the funding, because we are struggling to fund the posts that we have at the moment. The posts keep getting diminished, so there's more responsibility and more workload. So how do we keep finding the funding to bring in other people? And if we're not recruiting, how would we become more diverse? If our little pot of mainly white women is kind of is becoming smaller, you know, if we're not recruiting decent salaries, we're not, you know, how are people going to be? It's really difficult. But I think the more that we can get smaller pots of money and keep and keep working with people, and the importance of remuneration and not expecting everyone to do it for free, which is so cultural in museums. It's such a culture in museums. It's like museum staff get paid but not very much, and then everyone else is just expected to do it for free out of the goodness of their heart, kind of. That we need to get rid of. We're trying to get rid of that attitude, but it's got to be funding. It's got to be, it's got to be overall organisational strategy and wanting to work in this way. And I think we've got, like, Martin Pell, who also worked with us on this project, who's our costume textile curator, fashion textile curator, I think he is. He was involved in our project and came to the panel meetings, and he has recently done an LGBT project called Queer Looks, where they adopted the same model and used a community, where they created, worked with a community panel who made the decisions. And I think we need to look at ways in which we embed that as more widely into our organisation. And I think we've also got some legacy examples in terms of talking about what we've been doing and since we've seen each other, and talking about a project that the museum is involved with another panel member who's been, as well as Edith, really instrumental, Seppo Skwambane. And I've just been out to Botswana with him, working with a partner museum in Botswana, and the work we're doing with that is very much using the model that Seppo and I both worked on in
the Fashioning Africa,
the Fashioning Africa project, where we are filming people talking about their craft practice, Botswanan curators interviewing the practitioner in Swana and then translating, because it's Botswanan people and curators interviewing other Botswanan people rather than us going in there and sticking a microphone in someone's face and speaking in English. So I think I'm constantly learning.
What's become glaringly obvious through this project to me is what Rachel touched on. It's just not a diverse space. And that needs to be tackled all the way through, from its board to its staffing. You're never going to get outputs that reflect the diversity of 21st century Britain if the workforce isn't diverse. I think everyone agrees to that.
Yeah.
But I think, as Rachel mentioned, there are some structural issues as well that can... Well, funding sometimes, you know, roles being cut, people not being rehired. So these opportunities don't come up very often. But I think it needs to... It really... There's an urgent need diversify the workforce to reflect not just the local community that museums such as RPM serve, but, you know, Britain as a whole. Now, having said that, it's never going to be enough, even still, you know, because how many people work in a museum? So you still need to have mechanisms that allow other groups to permeate those museum spaces, to be able to express themselves, you know, in different ways. And I know it's funding heavy. I don't know, maybe it's to do with the way, I don't know, budgets are set, I don't know. But it needs to be valued. I think there is something to be said about the success that we've seen, how well the model works. It is expensive, but what do we do about it when we know that actually we get so much good, actually we get amazing work coming from this model? It just needs funding. So I think there needs to be some kind of restructuring in the way we look at how the museum model works best.
You know, how can we sort of change, you know, as individuals, how do we change things? We know what needs to be changed. How do we do that? How do we influence that? And I think that's what sometimes may be difficult or frustrating. And I wonder if we're talking about funding and the way things are funded. If what I'm trying to say is there's very deep-seated big things that need to change in terms of how we look at it's education, structural. How we value culture as a society, whose culture we value, whose heritage. It's very deep-seated, but I wonder in terms of us as individuals in small museums, or I wonder if it's just the trying to encourage funders to be saying, okay, how do we fill these gaps?
or just persisting with these models and setting them as standard.
And funders committing to fund these types of projects.
Fund these types of projects.
Yeah.
Institutions themselves adopting these newer models, newer ways of working that allow for partnerships that really value and share knowledge and allow for people to, you know, come into the spaces and author.
Yeah.
Mm.
Something that isn't talked about a lot is actually how we relate with the people we work with.
Yeah.
And I think very often, I mean, people like me, black women, or it could be someone from an LGBTQ, you know, just generally speaking, people who might be a minority, whatever your characteristic is within a particular group that sets you apart as a minority, can be or can be perceived within the individual to be a barrier. It may or may not be, but it can be perceived as. And you are already starting from a deficit point in your mind. You feel like, as you say, and this sometimes translates to the perception on the part of the institution that there isn't an appetite. There is an appetite. People do want to permeate these spaces, but sometimes you're working from a position where you feel like, I don't see myself reflected in this space.
No.
And so it feels like there's a much wider gap for this individual to overcome, to get to a point where they feel like they are reflected and accepted and can contribute positively and will be valued as an equal in those spaces. So what you want for that sort of thing is, you know, we don't really talk about these things, but you want kindness, you want friendliness, you want spaces where you feel welcomed, valued. These are the softer sides of things. It's not about funding alone. It's about feeling like, yeah, okay, you know, I can make that first step. Okay, and I'll come back tomorrow, we'll see, you know. and that's how relationships are formed. So in many ways, you know, when I talked about it being a relationship building exercise, it really was. And it wasn't just about individuals like me and Rachel getting to know each other better and working together. It was about communities as well, because in many ways the individuals who were part of the panel represented different communities.
I think we're also not very good at communicating what we do and who we work with and how we work with. I think there's often an assumption that we don't, if you see what I mean. So in the small ways maybe that museums are, there's actually, we're trying to look, I belong to the Museum Ethnographers Group, and we're trying to look at particularly repatriation and projects where we're looking at decolonizing, and it's such a big word, and what does it mean? And, but I think there's lots of museums, and we're saying often the small museums because you have more flexibility, who are really trying.
They are.
I don't know, you know, where we're getting
punching
all
above their weight.
Yeah,
really.
And, but also, and really trying to kind of move things forward and work differently. And I also don't think we're very good at shouting about that, because you're busy doing, and we don't have a big branding team or kind of. So I think often it's kind of how do we say to people, there are some small ways in which we're moving forward and our intentions are, I think we need to start putting out statements and saying, you know, what we stand for and what we do and what we don't stand for.
And doing it collectively is what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Keeps coming back to the collecting panel, but that's really important, saying, who's making the decisions? And people say, who's making the decisions? And I'm very proud to be able to say, not me as the curator, or not us as an organization, or not us as a body, or, you know, it's collective decision. It's people who are from the communities who have this incredible knowledge that are informing us.
You were going to just talk about kind of what's happened after Fashioning Africa with the object, continuing the object collecting. So I wonder if you could just say something about that and what's been happening.
We've touched a little bit on the Making African Connections project that we're working with the University of Sussex, and how we've looked at the kind of model of collecting for Fashioning Africa, and we've used the opportunity to collect just a few items in Botswana and some things that are relating to fashion and Fashioning Africa. And we've got a collection of shwe shwe fabric. And Seppo and I collected a few garments because we realised there was a gap in male shweshwe garments. So we collected a few pieces from Botswana and felt a lot more informed about how we were doing that and how we were starting to fill gaps in our Fashioning Africa collection. Mm-hmm. And also looking at the ways in which we might be displaying things or using things. And I talked about how we'd had a request for some of our kangas to go on display at Ipswich Museum, and talking about their display that it also involves three outfits from the Black Panther film. And we talked a little bit about this earlier, but it might be nice to kind of revisit that. And so we're looking at touring some of the collections and objects, and also how we can use those and how other museums might like to use them. So the kangas, first of all, we're going to have some historic examples from the 1980s, and then we're going to be using the LGBT kanga, which was created by an artist in Kenya. But they've asked to borrow the two to show how you can do sort of storytelling and how kangas communicate and particularly relate to women and women's values, politics, sexuality. So that's a really nice sort of thing that's come out of the project in terms
collecting,
of access.
Yes.
But when I heard about the Black Panther outfits, I also thought that was really interesting because from what I understand, and I haven't seen the film and I think you have, that there was an African-American designer, and I thought it was really interesting that she used different ideas of African fashion and adornment from all over Africa to create these outfits. And I thought it might be nice if we could lend some objects or suggest some objects that are historic that reflect that. And I wanted to get your take on that.
Absolutely. I think it sounds exciting. It's interesting for me looking at how Africans and African culture, especially when you're looking at the African American gaze, is homogenized into one culture. I suppose because of the way it's romanticized, you know. I think in a museum space, obviously, you have more of an opportunity to display, to provide context, to really touch on the object's individual history, mm-hmm. talk about other things like, you know, its relevance today, you know, the collector's information. But within the context of the Black Panther film, it's more entertainment.
Yeah, that's very true.
It's not conceivable that a film would be made about a utopian European country with textiles from all over the continent of Europe in this country, with one language spoken by, you know, all individuals, let's say Italian, and, you know, just a great big mishmash of. But I mean, it's entertaining, you know, especially if you see it as a celebration of the different cultures, and you see it as, you know, it's a form of romanticization. I think within the Black Panther, my boys love Black Panther. We've watched it about 10 times. Just generally in more, I don't want to say serious, but in contexts that lend themselves to education. And I'm not saying film doesn't. It does. But with film, you can suspend reality and plant yourself in this imaginative world. Mm. And it's about entertainment. But I think where we look at in the real world, there is a responsibility to represent things for what they really are. And I think also, particularly where African cultures are concerned, I think it's so important that we start to move away to start to tell more specific stories. Mm. And I have to say, with Fashion in Africa project, it's been great to see these individual stories developing, you know, with focus on Southern African cultures, you know, Botswana specifically right now. You know, with Ashoke, we did object journeys where we looked at the Ashoke fashion through the years. We had a display of about 8 objects that looked at Ashoke spanning 100 years or so. We looked at South African objects in a different display. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that we start to look at African cultures in a more specific way.
Yeah.
So you bring out
and other things,
more interesting stories.
Yeah, actually. And other things can feed in. When we did with the Object Journeys story, you know, I mean, Seppo's idea, yours came from a textile, and Seppo's came, it's really nice because there was very different approaches that you both took, and his came from his childhood and his memories of growing up in a township and who he saw around him. And we looked at migration. So I think it's really fascinating, the stories that you can tell through, and that enables us to use our historic collections and and our new collections to tell a very personal story.
You can build
in that
more
sense.
Detail.
Yeah.
You can...
I think it's a real good
build more knowledge.
Jumping off point. I like the just going back quickly to the Black Panther, I like the idea that we're finding out about through the Fashioning Africa and the things we've collected, we're getting involved in other projects that are going on.
Absolutely.
And people are starting to want to borrow material and use it in different ways.
That's
and I like the idea of maybe using it to unpick some of those things that you've talked about in terms of what that film represents, or to maybe look at an element of popular culture or a film and sort of unpick that a little bit in terms of lending material that might help tell some individual stories that can come out of that.
Yes.
I feel more confident now about knowing who I can go to work with and how to do that work. Mm. And we will keep working in this way. No matter what funding is available, we will make sure that this is our mode of working now, involving other people, and that feels really positive, empowering.
Absolutely. Ditto.
Well, that seems like a good place possibly to stop.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My thanks to Rachel and Edith for such a nuanced conversation in this episode. I really appreciate how frankly they spoke about the structural issues behind why contemporary museums still struggle to be diverse spaces. For funding reasons, yes, but also because of something that continues to pervade, to do with who does and who doesn't feel represented in this space. One answer, which Rachel and Edith thoughtfully pose, is that in building new collections such as Ashoke Fashion and Textiles, as well as continuing to welcome the reframing of historical collections by diverse community partners, museums can represent the stories of individuals who may not normally enter the space of the museum. Or, as Edith puts it, museums can begin to represent things for what they really are. Please do join me next time, where I'll be exploring the weird and wonderful world of the Booth Museum of Natural History, one of Brighton Museum Service's most unpredictable and fascinating spaces. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, hit like and subscribe, and please leave us a very nice 5-star review. Find out more about the Royal Pavilion Museums at brightonmuseums.org.uk and more about this project at oneby1.uk. On Twitter, I'm Soph_Frosty, and RPM is Brighton Museums. I really hope you can join me next time. Till soon, goodbye.
The voices of the Royal Pavilion and museums are supported by the oneby1 Research Project, the School of Museum Studies at the University of Leicester, The Keep, Arts Council England, and produced by Lo-Fi Arts.